course, the other 10 children show up and you're able to corral them. If the bikers find them, good luck convincing them to turn their kids over to you, shady fuckers. We have a plan for that contingency. Amy sighed and crumpled up her Cheetos bag. I'm sure you do. To the phone, Tasker said, Termination of the two existing specimens will proceed immediately. Mikey Payton is secure and will be here within 15 minutes. A team will be dispatched to the Loretta Knoll residence momentarily. Amy said, I want to go with them. You are not going to interfere. I don't want to interfere, but I want to be there. If you don't let me, then I'll interfere. Tasker said, Any further questions? The rumbling mountain voice spoke up once again, and this time it continued speaking. It was a voice I could feel in my gut and in my shoes as it rattled the floor. Gibson and Tasker listened intently, the way you'd listen to a jury delivering a verdict at your murder trial, the sound of fates being decided. It spoke for some time, maybe a full 2 minutes, and it was one of the longest 2 minute spans of my life. I tried to detect emotion in that voice to see if it was delivering good news or bad, if it was angry or pleased. But whatever sentiments were being expressed were beyond me, maybe beyond any human. Finally, the voice rumbled to a halt, the aftershocks subsiding. The sense of relief in the room was palpable. Tasker nodded, swallowed, and said, Yes, my lord, Thursday at 2. Chapter 23. A plan with no possible flaws. Amy. They were in John's Jeep, parked outside Taco Bill, on a street hidden under a sheet of rippling water, in a neighborhood that looked like it had dressed up as Venice for a costume party, and then woke up in a dumpster. Amy wasn't even sure why she had insisted on coming. Maybe she wanted one last look at Maggie, to try to see the monster, to shake this feeling. She had to admit, Non could certainly play subtle when they wanted to. Instead of rolling in with an army of scary-looking trucks and men in spacesuits, a sight all too familiar to the residents of this city, they had simply approached the Loretta Knoll home in the agent's nondescript sedan, followed by an ambulance. Had they stolen one? Amy watched as they approached the door and explained the situation to an increasingly panicked Loretta, then tried in vain to calm her. The story would be that the other abductee had tested positive for this dangerous toxin, that they just needed to bring Maggie in for tests, that every minute counted, blah, blah, blah. They all went inside, Amy figuring that the odds of them deciding to take the child by violence increased with every passing second. She got that bunny bread knot in her guts. But finally, the non-people emerged with Maggie, and right behind them was her mother. You'd have to kill Loretta, too. David reached back, took Amy's hand in his, and said, You did everything right, babe. Everything you said, we need you to say those things, to be that person. You were basing it on what you knew. You can't let it tear you up inside. That's what they want. But once you land on the right thing, you don't look back. You don't apologize. I know this looks different from your end, but you have to trust us here. Amy said, So now we're basically following Non's orders, and you're fine with that? I'm not fine with anything, ever. But as far as I can tell, what Non wants is to keep things on an even keel, to keep people from panicking. That's not always a terrible thing to want. Amy said, No, what they want, not just Non, but everyone like them, is for us not to panic, but to be just scared enough. You know that scene in They Live where he puts on the glasses and all the signs have all these propaganda messages hidden in them? In the real world, if you put on those glasses, all you'd see is one message repeated everywhere. Be anxious. Buy this thing or your friends will laugh at you. Eat this thing or you'll get fat and nobody will love you. Watch the news to find out who's trying to kill you today. Yeah, but all that stuff is real. There's actual reasons to be scared. The problem, David, is your cynicism only runs one direction. If somebody comes on TV and says everything is great and wonderful, you don't believe it. You say they're blowing smoke up your butt. You demand proof. But if 1 second later, some guy comes on and says everything is falling apart, you automatically believe it, no questions asked. If those people had told you that this mind monster situation was no big deal and that we should just go home, you wouldn't have believed them, not for a second. But the moment they said it was a Class G apocalypse, you were on board, as if nobody ever has motivation to tell you things are worse than they really are. And you know for a fact that's not true. Nothing controls people like fear. John said, "We're moving." They followed the sedan back toward the wellness center. On the way, a pair of the flat black trucks silently moved in front and behind them, ready to do containment if Maggie should transform and get loose. There were no incidents, however, and the three of them were allowed to follow the non-team back into the field HQ, where they proceeded to haul Maggie past the office area and toward that rear concrete wall with its huge steel door. The bizarre painted warnings had been covered by a series of posters reminding staff to wash their hands and to please dispose of food waste properly, lest it attract ants. The steel door slid open soundlessly, and Maggie and her mother were hauled into the chamber beyond. The little girl was bawling her eyes out, and Loretta seemed on the verge of a breakdown. Amy, John, and David followed them back. The steel door, Amy noted, was a foot thick. Beyond it were a number of cells with clear walls that Amy suspected were forged from a substance much stronger than plexiglass. This facility clearly had not been built within the last 2 days. Maggie was taken past the glass cells into a room at the end of the hall labeled Staff Only. This time, Loretta was made to stay outside, reassurances being muttered to her by a very competent-looking guy in doctor scrubs. Amy had the horrific thought that they were just going to euthanize Maggie right then, in that room, and that Amy would have to watch them break the news to Loretta. But about 10 minutes later, the staff-only door opened. It made a hissing sound, and a few kind-looking folks who looked like staff from a hospital pediatric unit led Maggie Knoll to one of the cells. Her hair was wet, and she was wearing baggy hospital pajamas, as if they'd hosed her down. Amy wondered if those people were actual medical staff, or if they were just actors Nan had hired for their false flag operation. The ominous black cloaks were nowhere to be found. Today, the facility was playing the part of a laboratory and wellness center to a T. Maggie Knoll went into the cell, crying but not resisting, and the glass door closed and sealed her in. Loretta, sobbing, was taken down the hall to answer some questions. As soon as her mother was out of range, Maggie instantly stopped crying. She stood perfectly still in the middle of her cell, made eye contact with Amy, and said, "Hi." For some reason, this seemed to creep David out quite a bit, and he actually took a step back from the glass wall. Amy didn't answer. Loretta was now talking to the non-agent, who was entering information on a tablet. Amy noticed the agent glance her way the moment she heard Maggie speak. Maggie said, "You seem nice." Amy said, "What are you?" Maggie shrugged. "I know you're not a little girl. What are you really? What are you really? Or maybe I should ask, what are you going to be once you grow up?" "I don't think I'm going to grow up." Amy tried to read the expression on the little girl's face, but couldn't. Finally, she said, "What you are, what you really are, can't live here." Maggie met her eyes. "When they brought me in just now, they took off my clothes and scrubbed me. That man over there in the lab coat, he watched, and he liked it. But he lies about it, about liking it. It's like that everywhere. Mommy thinks I'm weird, but she won't say anything. When they said they were taking me away, she was mad, but I could see that she was happy, too, way down inside, like she wouldn't have to be scared anymore. But she will hide it. Everybody is hiding what they really are, way down inside. That is not the same thing. What you are, you're going to hurt us if we don't do something. I said you seem nice, but you're going to kill me because of what you are inside." Amy heard the agent rapidly walking their way. "I'm not really talking to you. You can't even talk. You're not a little girl. You don't even have a mouth. This is all, it's all something you're doing to my brain." If a spider walks onto your bed, you squish it. If a butterfly lands on your bed, you take a picture. Is the butterfly doing something to your brain? If I didn't make myself look like this, I would already be dead. You kill everything that doesn't have pretty wings. So you're not dangerous? You're not going to grow up and declare war on us? Are you at war with the cows who give you milk? We're not going to be your cows, Maggie, if that's what you're getting at. We can't let that happen. Maggie shrugged. It's already happened. Me. Tasker's shoes clicked up the concrete, and I sensed she was about to tell us to stop interacting with the specimen. Before she could say anything, I put a hand on Amy's shoulder. Let's go. I pulled her away from the glass, which was now smeared with the ooze that had trickled off the enormous maggot that was sucking on it, its mandibles clicking off the surface like it badly wanted to bite its way through. Amy had been talking with the thing, and it bothered me that I couldn't hear both ends of the conversation. The effect of the sauce was fading, but it was next to impossible to hear Maggie unless I devoted every ounce of concentration to it. As we walked away, one of the non-doctors escorted the half-eaten Loretta up to Maggie's cell. Loretta put her hands up to the glass, asking the creature if it was okay, if it was feeling all right, reassuring it that they'd be going home soon. I put my hand on Amy's back and walked a little faster. To Tasker, I said, Mikey's here, or is he loose on the town, destroying everything we know and love? Tasker said, he's here. Came along without incident. John said, just like Maggie. Didn't put up a fight, didn't blow the cover. I said, okay, so we can trust you to actually kill these things? You're not going to change your mind and decide you want to keep them as biological weapons or something? Agent Tasker said, follow me. No, we don't need to see you do it. There's no reason to give Amy nightmares for the next 20 years. Amy said, I want to be there. Why? Tasker said, there's actually another reason. Come. She led us down the hall and then over to what turned out to be another cell block. How many were there? Which was uninhabited, save for a single cell occupied by a pulsing larva that I had to be told was Mikey. I made myself focus and found I could sort of see the disguise. But what I saw was clumsy, monstrous, a mannequin made by incompetent hands in the dark. Ridiculous to think that it had ever fooled me. Tasker said, as we alluded to on the conference call earlier, our past experience has found that one substance seems to be fatal to the... Is it sulfur? Said John. Taken aback, Tasker said, that's a key component. Yes, burning sulfur. It's embedded in a thermite compound formed into pellets that will ignite in midair. They should continue burning once they've penetrated the hide of the larva, releasing the sulfur internally. John said, and if you combine that substance with a piece of silicone in the shape of a human ass? Tasker just stared. I said, so it's that simple. After all this talk of interdimensional energies and entities and all that, we're just burning holes in them? So what are we waiting for? It's actually not that simple. Sulfur doesn't work for its chemical properties. It works because it has, let's just say, symbolic power. There is an invisible mechanism at play. Sure, it's a vampire holy water situation, I get it. I don't think you do. From previous incidents with similar organisms, the effectiveness of the weapon has varied wildly according to who is wielding it, and their state of mind at the moment the fatal blow is struck. I said, okay. We are requesting that you do it, at least for this specimen. Agent Gibson shuffled over, holding a modified shotgun.
Don't get cute and shoot this at me, dirtbag.
Amy glanced at the gun and muttered, Wellness Center. John lit a cigarette. Tasker said, There's no smoking in here.
If he gets to shoot a gun indoors, I'm thinking I can smoke a cigarette.
Amy said, We're obviously not going through with this. Even I can see this trap coming. She nodded toward me and said,
They stick you in the cell, Mikey eats you. Since they didn't do it directly, they think they escaped the supposed curse that's protecting us. I said, you two are staying outside the cell, right? I'm the only one that goes in. You guys stay out here and watch for shenanigans. I mean, we were just in the room with this thing earlier today. I don't think this is among the top 10 scariest creatures that have tried to eat me. I've got to say, I'm fine with it. Amy made an exasperated noise and said, why are you fine with it? Because we were hired by Chastity to do a job, and this is it. Didn't you just tell me I needed to see things through? Well, here's Mikey. It's not what we expected, but so what? For better or worse, this is the final resolution to the Peyton case. I took the shotgun from Agent Gibson. I pulled back the slide enough to confirm there were in fact shells in it, and that they weren't going to stick me in the cell with an empty gun. I sniffed it. The shells smelled like farts, all right. I asked Tasker, so how does this, process work? You'll go into the adjacent cell, here. The walls between cells slide open, that is done remotely, from the guard room. Exterior door closes, wall opens, there'll be nothing between you and the specimen. Fire at will. Amy said, David, this is stupid. That has literally never stopped us before, even once. I asked Tasker, Loretta and Maggie aren't going to be concerned by the sound of gunfire? We'll close the door between cell blocks. They're utterly soundproof. It'll be no louder to them than someone softly knocking on the wall. I looked toward John, and he shrugged. I mean, if we're not here to do this, why are we here? To Amy, I said, you see the kid in there, right? He's just staring at me, accusingly. Do you need to go wait down the hall or something? You going to be able to handle this? No, I won't be able to handle it, and yes, I should be here anyway. Let's get it over with. I stepped into the adjacent cell, and the door slid closed behind me. The invisible hand of claustrophobia slowly but firmly squeezed my butthole. The wall that separated the cells was solid steel. I couldn't see what was happening in Mikey's cell. Through the glass, I asked John, if you concentrate, can you see and hear Mikey, or is it just the larva the whole time? Give me a second. Yeah, I can see Mikey pretty clearly, if I try. What's he doing? Sitting on the bed now, crying, asking why we're here, why his mother doesn't want him. I made eye contact with Amy, who looked distraught. Fresh cut grass. That's all it is. To Tasker, I said, there's not going to be any ceremony or ritual here. You open that wall, I'm pointing the gun, and I'm pumping sulfur rounds into that thing until the gun goes click. Whatever data you're looking to collect, you'll have to collect it from that. Tasker said, you're ready? Yeah. The wall slid open. Sitting in the other cell, on the bed, was Mr. Nymph. Chapter 24. An experiment yields some inconsistent data. He was wearing a clean black suit, coldly staring me down. I had the thought that it should have been like looking in a mirror. His was, in the basics anyway, my own face. I thought it seemed off, somehow. Then I remembered that it's because the image wasn't reversed. It put my scar on the wrong cheek. He also just looked so much healthier, so much more alive. I aimed the shotgun. Nymph said, do it. I didn't. John said, Dave, do it, man. Nymph said, you heard him. Do it. I can see that you feel the doubts creeping in, the fear. Interesting to see if you can stand up to it. I said, shut up. We keep arriving back to this point, do we not? So, are you a man, or are you a hollow vessel echoing with mindless desire? Your fear says to take one step back and let them close up that wall again. So, which will act next, the man or the fear? For it is in this moment, the moment in between feeling an impulse and succumbing to it, that you actually exist. Soon the waves of impulse will crash in and your soul will be swept out to sea. When my master consumes you, I doubt he will find you a terribly crunchy morsel. You don't exist. You're a manifestation of the swarm, built to play on our self-doubt. Break you down and you're just a bunch of mindless insects who've learned to push people's buttons. If I pull out a handful of your cells, would they add up to anything more? So at what point do they become you? John shouted for me to shoot, and this seemed like great advice. I raised the shotgun, and in the time it took me to send the command to my trigger finger, Nymph managed to spring from the bed, fly across the room, and start ripping the gun from my hands. The two of us both wound up on the floor, and I had a moment to remember that John had done this exact thing with the Ted doppelganger, and that he had been tricked into killing Ted, and then, for the first time, I realized that in that story, not even the gun had been real. As if it had wanted him to shoot. Why? And in that brief moment of doubt, the gun was torn from my grasp. Nymph stood and aimed it right at my face. John said, "Shoot! David! I don't have the gun!" Confusion outside. I opened my mouth to say, "What are you seeing?" But at that moment, Nymph opened his mouth, and in my voice said, "John, what are you seeing?" John said to Nymph, "I'm seeing two of you." Amy said, "Oh my God." Agent Gibson said, "Well, look at that. We got an evil twin situation here." I said, "He's the one in the suit, guys." John said, "You're both wearing the same thing." "Oh, God damn it, John, concentrate. See past the disguise. The one without the gun, meaning me, is the real David. Look at me. Look at him." Nymph said, "He's lying. You know he's lying." John stared, first at Nymph, then at me. He shook his head and said, "When I concentrate, you both look like, I don't know, man. He's doing something." Nymph somehow smirked without moving his face. I sighed. I said to Tasker, "You know what these things are vulnerable to, and you knew what this facility would be used for. I'm going to take a wild guess and say that as an emergency measure, each of these cells are rigged to rain burning sulfur down on whoever's inside, despite being a massive violation of state and local building codes. Am I right?" She didn't answer, because she didn't know if she was talking to a person or a monster larva. But her expression, plus previous experience with this organization, told the story. She, or somebody, probably in that guard room she mentioned, just needed to push a button. Probably. I said, "Let's assume that's true. Here's what's going to happen. He's going to make a play to try to get you to open that door. He can do it one of two ways, either by trying to convince you he's me and to just let him out, or by doing what I think he's going to do, which is just shoot me and have me out of the way, at which point he'll have all the time in the world to convince you of whatever he wants. I'm going to try to stop him, but I probably won't be able to. He's stronger and faster. When that happens, when he kills me, I want you to push the button that fills this cell with fire. This cell and the one with Maggie. Kill us all." Amy said to Tasker, "Don't do it. That's what it wants." I said, "You know this is me." I looked at John. "You too. The monster just wants out. I want Amy to be safe. And by far the safest option is just to kill us both. Easy answer." I stared down Nymph, who was grinning like an asshole. I said, "I don't know who or what you really are. And at this point, I really don't care. Whatever levers you think you can pull in people's minds, playing off their soft hearts, you're going to find all those circuits are dead in me. It's not pretty, but neither is that shit-encrusted plunger we keep next to the toilet. But in the moment that toilet starts to overflow, that shit-encrusted plunger is the most beautiful thing in the world. Well, that's what I've come to realize over the years. I'm that plunger, that stinking necessary thing. So you're standing there with your gun and your plans, thinking you can reach into their heads out there and play their emotions like a tune. But it's not them in the cell with you, it's me. And your unholy hive mind forgot to account for one thing. I just do not give a fuck." Nymph nodded, as if in admiration. Then he set the shotgun on the floor. He said, "You know what? You're right." He turned to the group in the hall and said, "Fry us both. It's the only way to be sure." He turned to me and got a pensive look in his eyes. "I've seen things you wouldn't believe. I have seen a snail get eaten by a bird, survive its digestive tract, then get shit out 200 miles away onto the roof of the World Trade Center 5 minutes before the first plane hit. I have seen a man's body obliterated by a train because he was trying to retrieve a dropped slip of paper that a woman had written her phone number on, not realizing the number was fake. I have seen an entire species-changing genetic line wiped out when a single Homo erectus got his dick stuck while humping a knothole. All these moments forgotten, like piss in a swimming pool. Time to die." I turned back toward the hall, feeling an odd sense of relief, trying to quickly put together my last words to Amy. It wouldn't need to be anything too profound. Why start now? I met her eyes, and it took me a moment to realize there was no glass between us. She was standing in the open door to the cell. She screamed, "Come on!" at the exact moment Agent Gibson arrived to try to wrestle her away from the door. Nymph flew toward the open door, trying to blow past me. I threw my body at him and slammed him onto the floor, and I couldn't tell if I was feeling the flesh and bone body of a dude in a business suit or the squishy, pulsing mass of the fuckroaches. I think I was feeling them both at the same time. The shotgun skidded across the floor, bounced off the wall, and skipped back toward me. I crawled over Nymph, grabbed the gun, and shoved the barrel into the back of his head. I yanked the trigger. Click. I pumped it and pulled the trigger again and again. Nothing. Tasker had sabotaged it. Pulled out the firing pin, probably. That bitch. Nymph flung me aside and bowled past Amy into the hall. I followed. Alarms were sounding. Black cloaks were flowing into the hall from wherever they'd been hiding. I yelled for John, but couldn't find him in the pandemonium. The cloaks aimed their strange weapons at both me and Nymph. Tasker said, "Don't harm the specimen." I said, "You just said you were going to kill it." "That was a test." Nymph said, "Hold on. So now, is it better for me to be the specimen or David?" Amy pushed herself away from Gibson and pointed to me. "This is the human, unfortunately." The black cloaks moved in on Nymph, so I guess they believed her. He raised his right hand. Everything from the elbow down disintegrated into a flock of about 10 fuckroaches. They flew toward the nearest cloak, who was wearing a rubber mask that gave him the slack face of an elderly woman. The insects landed on various points of its body, then quickly burrowed through the cloak and body armor. The thing in the cloak screamed an inhuman scream, and then exploded, as if the fuckroaches had pulled it apart from the inside. Grayish-blue hunks of meat landed everywhere. It had the texture of a vegetarian recipe for imitation human tissue. The rest of the cloaks recoiled, but again didn't fire. They were waiting for the order, though at least they now knew which one was me. Nymph gave me a smug look and said, "You cannot comprehend the suffering that is about to occur, Mr. Wong. You said you don't give a fuck, and I believe you. You think none of it matters, that it's all a big joke. But I assure you, Mr. Wong, right now, no one is laughing." There was a commotion from behind Nymph, and I heard John screaming, "Fart dildos coming through!" There was a mechanical noise like air brakes. A projectile hit Nymph and filled the hall with sizzling sparks. Nymph went to the floor, a smoldering hole in his back, hunks of metal burning brightly in the wound. The smell of sulfur filled the hall. John was holding a homemade weapon. The barrel was PVC pipe, leading to a complex mechanism like the cylinder on a revolver. Only instead of bullets, each chamber contained one sex toy. On his back was a tank of compressed gas. John fired again. A pink projectile whizzed through the air, made impact with Nymph, and exploded in that shower of pungent fire. The fuckroaches scattered.
The black cloaks unleashed their strange weapons on the bugs, vaporizing them in midair, with orange beams that radiated ungodly amounts of heat. I wondered if they ever accidentally fired their weapons on the wrong setting. Then, all that remained was the larva, writhing in pain on the floor, shed of its disguise. The burning chunks of thermite and sulfur were eating through its skin. It seemed to be pulsing, swelling. John cocked his dildo cannon and fired again. The maggot squealed and thrashed, but it was still not dead. The smoldering embers of sulfur ate through its husk, and still it seemed to get bigger. I said, "Where the hell did you get that thing?" "It was in the back of the Jeep. We must have built it while we were on the sauce. The memory hit me all at once. Want me to shoot it again?" Amy said, "Look." A split had formed in the maggot's thick outer skin, where the sulfur had finally burned through. The larva was now nearly twice its former size, its skin stretching and pulling like a bratwurst on a grill. From within the wound, a sheer blackness seemed to leak out like steam, and from it, I sensed an infinite coldness that defied all reason. "We're too late." John said, "Is it dying?" Amy shook her head. "No, it's hatching." Chapter 25. Well, they certainly fucked that up, didn't they? I said, "How do we stop it?" Tasker, thinking quickly, said, "Get it out of the cell block! To the front!" I grabbed the maggot, it was unsettlingly warm, and tried to drag it. Its skin was slick but tough, hard to get a grasp on it. I twisted it in my fists and pulled, like dragging a bag of wet cement. I screamed for John. He tossed his dildo cannon aside and tried to grab on. We screamed for one of the cloaked guards to pitch in, but they didn't seem to recognize the command. The dark foot-long fissure in the larva's hide grew wider. A dim rumble came from inside, low enough to shake the floor. Or maybe I was imagining that part. Agent Gibson came hobbling along and tried to help. John said, "Roll it, like a barrel." The three of us did just that, making slow progress up the hall, through the cell block door, and toward the open steel door to the office area. This would force us to roll it past Maggie's cell, and I expected to hear Loretta start screaming at the sight of us. But someone had apparently hustled her back into the staff-only area, getting her out of the way. We made it past Maggie's cell, the larva inside shrieking and thrashing at the sight of us, and through the thick steel door. I was sweating with the effort. The thing seemed to gain mass with every step. We were leaving a trail of ooze behind us. Tasker was waiting by the black coffin device to our left, the portal to other worlds. She waved us that way, and we had to again do an awkward 90-degree turn with the pulsing grub. Tasker pulled open the door, and beyond was that vast green field I'd glimpsed earlier. Scattered around the other side was various trash, coffee cups, chip bags, at least one dirty diaper. The maggot was too long to fit through the door now. All five of us, Amy included, had to wrestle it through lengthwise. It huddled on the other side of the door, and Tasker yelled for us to push it farther in, to get it away from the portal so the offspring couldn't jump through if it hatched at exactly the wrong moment. I said, "You go through first, sweetheart. We're not going through only to have you close the door behind us." To her credit, she didn't hesitate. She jumped through and pulled as we pushed, shoving the larva across the field and down what turned out to be a grassy hill in some other time and place and universe. The moment our hands were off it, the husk of the maggot split along its body, its skin falling aside. For a moment, there was only a blotch of blackness there, and all five of us stared at it, transfixed. Tasker held up her phone to get video, eyes wide in amazement. This was once-in-a-lifetime data. I noted she had a pistol in her other hand until she glanced down at it and realized that what emerged from this thing would not even find her bullets particularly annoying. The blackness grew. Amy backed toward the portal and said, "This world, it's uninhabited, right?
There's an empty universe for this thing to wreak havoc in?
Tasker didn't answer. I turned to go back through the portal and stopped. There stood the door, and behind it was a well-dressed family of what looked like tourists, a father and two boys eating some kind of bulbous turquoise dessert I'd never seen before. The father was staring at us in bafflement. He looked like a steampunk lawyer in a waistcoat and high, shiny boots, a gold chain draped over one shoulder. He had well-oiled black hair with a skunk stripe of white that ran back from his forehead. His two well-groomed boys seemed only mildly curious. One of the boys looked at me and said something that sounded like, away, but the accent and tone made me think it was a greeting in a foreign tongue. They had a little dog with them. It barked. The boy had been in the middle of feeding it a bit of his snack. I started to say, you should back away from this thing. But then my eyes registered what I was seeing, and the words died. Behind the family was a scenic little town square, gift shops and fountains surrounding a large clock tower. Rolling down the narrow streets were cars of unusual design that seemed to all have three wheels, one in back, two in front. Beyond the square were neat little cottages as far as the eye could see. Amy said, "Oh my God," and I turned back to where the larva had been, now a shriveled husk. Blackness poured out, up and up into the sky, like the plume from an oil well fire. The darkness coalesced into a shape like a giant headless man with goat legs at least 100 feet tall. I knew I should run, but when I tried, my feet stayed planted, as if saying, "Are you seeing this shit?" John grabbed my sleeve and pulled me toward the portal. But the moment I spun around, the shadow giant swept overhead, blotting out the sun. It descended on the village. The tourist family didn't scream. They didn't have time or a reason to. Neither did anyone in the village. As the shadow swept over them, it did not destroy the village. It simply changed it. I knew the process from prior experience. It simply reached back in time, thousands of years, maybe millions, and tipped a series of events. As it passed overhead, striding on its goat legs, the village was replaced, and so were the people. Where the tourist family had stood were now 2 8-foot-tall humanoid beings, skin encrusted with ash-gray scales like the bark of a tree that had survived a forest fire. Their eyes were big and black and cold. They wore clothing that had the look of armor, polished and ornate, full of sinister sharp edges. One of the beings was holding a leash, and at the end of it was a naked human child. Its arms and legs had been severed at the joints, the stumps covered in scars and calluses from where it had been walking on all fours all its life. It was starving, skin stretched over its ribs, a slit of white scar tissue where its genitals should have been. The child grunted. It was in the middle of defecating. It then turned and sniffed what it had made. In the village beyond, I tried to take in the civilization that had replaced what had been there moments ago. The bark-skinned beings strode around stone buildings that all seemed to have been designed to withstand an invasion from the ground, high, windowless walls and heavy doors. The vehicles that prowled the streets all seemed to be military in nature, armored, and on tank treads, rumbling slowly down streets made of some kind of black cobblestone. I saw two more human children, only I now realized they actually weren't children. That was just the size at which their growth was stunted. They were loping down an alley, grunting after a rodent they'd seen. In the street nearest to us, there was a cloud of flies around a pale, twisted shape lying at the end of a brown smear. One of the humans had been run over and left to rot in the sun. At the center of town, where before had been the tall clock tower, was a pile of human skulls, maybe 30 feet wide and 100 feet tall. It looked old and sacred, a memorial to some historic victory. One of the bark-skinned things in front of us shouted a stern command in our direction. He pulled from his back a weapon that looked like a whip, a black handle that led to a bundle of lengths of thin chain. He clicked the handle, and the end of each bit of chain glowed orange, as if the whip was designed to brand the flesh as it lashed it. He let go of the leash, and the stunted man on all fours came bounding in our direction. It made a noise at us, a wet, barking grunt.
Aye! Aye!
And then he spat something that sounded like,
Submit!
Amy screamed. I felt Tasker shove past me. The man-dog ran, filthy shoulders and ass cheeks bouncing, eyes wild.
I submit, submit, I submit, I submit, I submit, I submit.
John was shouting, and then I was being shoved through the portal and found myself back in the non-facility. Tasker had skidded to her knees, having stumbled in her rush to get through. Her suit jacket had flipped up, revealing the holster clipped to her waistband that contained her pistol.
Submit! I submit!
The man-dog was coming around, heading for the open portal. I could smell it, the stench of human body odor and fresh shit. I snatched the pistol out of Tasker's holster, spun around, and shot the pathetic thing in its dumb, filthy face, an inch below a matted, filthy white streak of hair dangling over its brow. The thing flopped over and skidded to a stop inches from the door. John quickly closed the coffin door, and I tossed Tasker's gun to the floor next to her. Breathing heavily, John looked at me and said,
That's the biggest night shart yet.
Tasker looked at Gibson and said,
Send a memo.
This is now Class H. I said,
There's a category beyond extinction level?
John said,
18, apparently. Guys, the Maggie larva was, birthed at the exact time as Mikey, right? So that means she could hatch at any second if it's not happening right now.
We all stared at each other for a moment, then ran back through the open steel door, down the row of cells until we found Maggie's. Her mother was there now. Whatever pretense had gotten her out of the way before hadn't held up for long. John, Amy, and I skidded to a stop in front of the half-eaten woman. Loretta's eyes went wide. Well, one of them did. The other had been chewed off, along with the left third of her skull, the harried woman wondering what the hell the commotion was about. Agent Tasker, who'd been moving at a more dignified pace, dictated by the constraints of her business-like skirt, arrived behind us. The Maggie larva looked unchanged for the moment. Tasker said to Loretta,
Why don't you come with me? We need to run some quick tests.
You can run them with me here.
Loretta, even with several bites having been taken out of her brain, was no dummy. Tasker said,
This is a requirement, unfortunately. It would be dangerous for you.
I accept the danger. Give me a waiver. I'll sign it.
Agent Gibson was approaching as well, his cane a third footstep clicking on the floor with each stride. Reaching inside his suit jacket, ready to do this the hard way, or, let's be honest, the easy way. He said,
Come on, Ms. Knoll. Don't make us.
He flinched at the sound of exploding windows behind him. Chapter 26. Grappling hooks aren't cheap, you guys. John. Everyone ran back out of the cell block into the office area they'd just vacated. Ted Knoll and his comrade were disconnecting the ropes they'd used to swing through the conference room windows from the roof. They whipped assault rifles around to their shoulders and moved out among the cubicles. A half dozen of the non-cloaks swarmed out to meet them. Ted and his partner fired exactly six shots. All six targets flopped onto the floor. Not a word had been uttered. Ted pointed his assault rifle at Dave and said in a surprisingly calm voice,
Where is she?
John said,
You don't want to do this, Ted, because of the radiation? It's just everywhere. We're all radioactive.
Drop the cover. She told me everything.
She?
John wasn't sure who he was talking about there. Was it Chastity? Maybe she'd come back to help. Loretta appeared in the doorway to the cell block, yelling her husband's name, asking him what in the world was happening. Ted ran in that direction, shouldered past her, and found Maggie's cell. The only glass wall that was smeared with the cloudy film from where the larva had been crawling over it. John, Dave, and Amy followed him in, Dave ineffectually telling him to wait, to listen. Ted told Maggie to hang on, then to no one in particular said,
Open the cell door.
The agent Dave called Tasker, but whose name was actually Pusnado, sauntered up and said,
I will not be doing that, and I assure you I have very good reasons.
I wasn't talking to you. Ted touched an earpiece and said, Are you reading me? I need that cell door opened now. The door slid open, the monstrous writhing maggot beyond it squealing and chittering in response. Ted reached down, clutched it to his chest, and shouted commands to his friend to cover their exit. Dave said,
Mr. Knoll, you need to listen very, very carefully. You take her out that front door. Everybody dies. Everything dies. I can't even explain the degree to which shit will go wrong.
Now it was Ted's turn to look confused, which quickly turned to annoyance. He seemed to think the two of them were still playing a part, maybe for Nan's benefit. In a tone that was only somewhat convincing, he said, Buddy, you can either stand aside and let me take my daughter out of here, or you can lay dead on the floor while I take my daughter out of here, playing along, giving Dave an out. Dave looked pleadingly at John. What could they do? Ted and his partner were armed to the teeth and apparently ex-special forces. John had nothing but his car keys in his pocket. He doubted he could kill more than one of them before the other took him down. Ted brushed past him and moved toward the front entrance of the wellness center, his partner covering the extraction, Loretta right behind them. John, Amy, and Dave watched as the larva passed out of the facility and back into the rain-lashed world. From behind John, Amy said, Guys, is this part of what you set up? Over the weekend, I mean?
John said, Maybe.
Damn it, Dave, you should have let me finish explaining it on your ass. But Dave was already moving, running after the dildo launcher John had discarded on the floor. John saw no good ending to Dave trying to fling flaming vibrators at this enraged soldier's little girl, but he didn't respond when John told him to forget it. John turned and chased after Ted, pushing through the front door in time to see Ted's Impala skid to a stop, spraying rainwater from all four tires. The passenger side window rolled down. Korean adult website star Joy Park said, Get her in! Move! Move! Dave ran up behind John with the dildo launcher, looked at Joy, then looked at John, bewildered. John just shook his head. Ted gently handed the squirming larva to Loretta, who climbed into the back seat with it. Ted told them to get to the safe house, that he would meet them there. Instead of raining dildo hellfire down upon Ted's family, Dave said, Wait, and told them to pop the trunk. He threw the launcher in and told Ted they may need it, which was true, but how in the hell they would figure it out in time, if it wasn't already too late, was anyone's guess. When Maggie hatched, John figured they'd have a brief moment to register the strange darkness, and then would know nothing at all. Dave slammed the trunk, and the car tore out of the parking lot. Ted, steadfastly ignoring John, Dave, and Amy, stormed back into the building with his soldier companion in tow. Agents Pusnado and Coxman were standing there, looking annoyed. John had expected 100 of those black cloaks to come flying out from various doors to wipe out Ted's two-man crew, but the building seemed to have emptied. For a moment, John was amused by the thought of them just giving up on their field office at the first sign of trouble. But then it occurred to him that Nan may very well have given an evacuation order for all of their staff in the facility. Hell, maybe the entire planet. John imagined all of them fleeing to some other dimension, marking this one down as a loss. Coxman shifted his weight on his cane and said,
Mr. Knoll, I understand what you think you're doing, but you need to—
Ted shot the man in the forehead, spraying blood and brain matter on his partner's blazer. Amy gasped. The man slumped to the ground, and Ted said to the female agent, Lie flat on the floor, put your hands behind your head. You and I are going to have a conversation. She obeyed. Ted took her gun from under her jacket and kicked it across the floor. He then slung his assault rifle behind his back and pulled out a black military-issue knife. Dave said, Ted, we should get out of here. Whatever you're about to do, it's not worth— Ted slapped Dave across the face with his dick, proverbially, via a stern facial expression. To the woman on the floor, he said,
Do you know what I did in Iraq?
I do.
Say it.
You were an interrogator, among other things.
Huh. Not many people got access to those records. How did I know you people would?
Point is, I know how to spot a lie.
And I got a short fuse for liars. You read about that too, didn't you? Even though it was kept quiet, that whole incident.
I am aware of your issues.
Ted nodded. Good. You know what it's like, being in a war zone?
Mr. Knoll, I can help you.
It's like waking up from a dream. I don't mean coming back home is like that. I mean the war, being in the suck. It's like waking up. See, because that's when you figure out your old life. The barbecues and Monday night football and trips to Disneyland, that shit was the dream. And this is real. Iraq was fucked, and getting it unfucked meant killing a certain number of people, and if it didn't get unfucked, then they would kill a certain number of us, and the future of the world would all depend on who killed who. Simple as that. Same as there's no woolly mammoths or saber-toothed tigers no more. Same as how we're all fancy monkeys instead of smart dinosaurs, and all that other bullshit, the steak dinners and Christmas mornings and beer commercials, it's all a dream we're having. Something to pass the time until somebody comes and wakes us up to the real world, where either you're gonna die, or you're gonna make somebody else die, so you can pass on your way of life to your kids. I'm saying all of this because I think part of what you're depending on here is me being unwilling to do what I need to do in order to find out what I need to know. So I'm letting you know, from one awake person to another, that the sight of your tears and the sound of your screams won't melt my heart. She said,
duly noted.
Knowing that I can spot a liar, even one with her face pressed to the floor, I ask you, were you or were you not about to kill my daughter?
We were not about to kill your daughter.
This, John noted, was 100% true. Ted seemed to recognize that fact. Amy said,
Mr. Knoll, we can actually explain.
He ignored her, continuing his interrogation. Do you or do you not know where to find the thing that's taking the children, the Bat Mantis? Pusnado hesitated, then chose her words carefully.
We believe we know where to find the creature that is behind all of this. Yes,
we believe we know how to kill it. Also true. Why did you take Maggie? Again, she chose her words carefully.
You are aware, Mr. Knoll, that the enemy is a shapeshifter, a being that has perfected camouflage. Examining Maggie was the only reasonable course of action, and there was no way to convey this without alarming her mother.
Ted stared, trying not to show any change in expression. He swallowed. And? We found that Maggie had not been replaced by a doppelganger. Again, technically true. Ted nodded. See? That wasn't so hard. So how do we kill it? The thing that's behind all this?
We just finished a device. It's in the back, in the armory. Take it to the creature's nest, those three know where it is, and set it off. And when I use the word nest, I want you to understand that this nest contains larvae. That is, the creature is about to multiply.
At any moment, Ted said, outstanding. You're going to take us to the armory. He handed John a heavy white plastic zip tie and said, bind her hands behind her back and lift her to her feet. John had no idea if the agent was planning an ambush here or if the device she spoke of was even real. He could read the same doubt on Dave's face. Amy, on the other hand, was just staring at the dead man on the floor. The look on her face said something different. It's all falling apart. Blood-splattered non-agent Jocelyn Pusnado led them past the cells, through the staff-only door, and through another enormous steel door that she apparently opened with her mind. Inside, among 500 objects that looked like spare parts for Satan's robot army, was a ribbed, stainless steel box the size of a steamer trunk. Pusnado said, it's inside. Spherical casing, explosively formed penetrators all around the outer shell. At the moment of detonation, it will throw waves of molten metal over 100-yard radius, thermite and sulfur. No remote detonator. You've got 3 minutes on the fuse. She nodded to John to open the case, making him wonder if it was booby-trapped. John considered making her open it, but
But he supposed that would mean untying her hands, and for all they knew, the box was full of weird guns she'd whip out at them. John looked for a latch, but found none. There was just a hole at the front of the lid, about big enough to get two fingers into. The agent said, "You need a special tool to open it. On the lid, you'll see a hole about 2 inches wide. It leads to a shaft about 8 inches deep. You need to insert a rigid object to depress the latch." John said, "Don't worry. I have just the thing." Me. "Here," I said. "We'll use this broomstick I found." I unlatched the lid, and inside was the bomb, a flat black sphere the size of a basketball, a thick, foot-long fuse sticking out of the top. Along the front, in white letters, was stamped the word "bomb." Ted yelled for his army buddy, who came and scooped up the device, then jogged off with it. Ted pointed his gun at Tasker and said, "One last question. If I leave you here, can you guarantee that neither you or your people will come after Maggie?" She paused, but not out of fear, steeling her resolve. "Mr. Knoll, I can guarantee that we will come after her. I'm sorry, but we don't have a choice." He shot her right in the heart. Chapter 27. This womb of mine. Outside the front door was waiting a camouflage pickup truck, Ted's army buddy at the wheel. Ted jogged toward it, making like he was going to leave without saying a word. John said, "Wait! The woman who was driving your car. Who is that? What's her deal? Or just, what's the deal in general? I hope you don't get offended, buddy, but communication within your chain of command is shit. Joy found me right after I left the cannery, said you sent her. Said Maggie was gonna get taken to this facility and that she had a way into the guard room. Acted like you people had been setting it up for a while." He climbed into the pickup and nodded back toward the bed. "I've got the asses." In the bed of the truck were the boxes of silicone butts that had been in my apartment. I said, good. "Where's the nest?" "The what?" "The nest of the thing, the Bat Mantis." "Oh, right. Tell you what, I'll ride with you. I can show you. Speaking of which, where is, Joy taking your daughter?" "They're on the way to meet Marconi at the Walmart. Joy said she'd be safe with him." "Oh, yes, right. Good." I felt a small pair of moons roll off my shoulders. Marconi will know what to do, and maybe we don't even need to be there to see it. If, that is, Maggie doesn't hijack his brain. Of course, we had no guarantee Joy was actually taking her there, or that she wasn't in cahoots with the thing in the mine, or that Maggie wouldn't hatch on the way. The pickup had a back seat. I climbed in, and John and Amy ran off toward the Jeep. Ted nodded to the man in the passenger seat. The guy was holding the bomb in his lap like he was bringing home a watermelon from the supermarket, and said, "This here is Philip. Everybody calls him Shitbeard. Good to meet you." He did not have a beard. "We're going to the pond at Mind's Eye. It's where we found Maggie. You're going to turn up here at the..." "I know where Mind's Eye is. Been out there before."
"You have?
When?" My phone rang. It was Marconi. I answered, "Yes, doctor." "Mr. Wong, I have received a very frightened little girl, her panicked mother, and a Korean woman who insisted I call you right away." "Sure. The young girl and her mother are..." I glanced at Ted. "In a similar situation to Mikey. The Korean woman is adult film star Joy Park. You're surely familiar with her work. Make sure Maggie gets, treatment immediately."
"Treatment?"
"Yes. We were able to treat Mikey. He's all good now."
"He is? In what way?"
Right. I'm in the car with Maggie's father right now."
Hesitation.
"I see. Loretta Knoll is here in the room with me, in fact." Remember how Amy and I proposed two possible options? They went with my suggestion, not hers.
It worked.
"I see. Our friends discovered a method, I take it?"
"Yes. You know what? Call John. He can fill you in. There's something in the trunk of Joy's vehicle. It will require some explaining. Quite a bit, in fact."
"I see.
Anyway, I just want to be clear that you definitely shouldn't keep her waiting. In a situation like this, every second counts.
Are you and Mr. Knoll heading my way?
No, we're on our way to Mind's Eye. We're going to finish this.
Amy.